This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So for those of you who might not have been here for the first session, we're studying the Eightfold Path. And in that session, we took up the Four Noble Truths, which was the Buddha's first teaching, and in which the Eightfold Path is brought forth. And so what we'll do in these subsequent sessions, it'll go on into the winter, because we're not going to finish them this fall, is look at each of these steps, each of these factors of the Eightfold Path. And what I'd like to do is, or what I'd like you to do, really, is what I'm going to be doing is just sort of drawing together the basic teachings on each of these factors. And so it's nothing new. What I'm offering is nothing new. In fact, Dharma teaching is never new. it's just presenting the Dharma again, sometimes in a new way, or sometimes we hear it. More often we hear it in a new way. But so what I'm going to do in each session is just bring forth the basic teachings as they're presented by the Buddha and throughout history, and then make some comments, but really draw upon your questions and comments. And so to really make this fruitful for you, you know, to not think of this as a lecture where I'm talking and you're just absorbing information, but that you're really studying particularly each step, each path, aspect of the path before we meet, so that it's really inside of you, and you're gathering your own thoughts and questions about it, so that you can bring those all together here, and that we can use that as fodder to clarify. You know, and that's a traditional way of teaching, is that the teachings themselves are very dense, in a sense. They're very terse, often very concentrated. And then the assumption was that teachers would sort of expand on and flesh out those teachings. So that's what we'll be doing. And so I hope all of you have had a chance to, or most of you, I know some of you are new to residence, but have had a chance to look at this. So today we're looking at right understanding, which is the first of the Eightfold Path, and right view also is how it's described. And so to put this, the Eightfold Path, into the very basic framework of the Buddha's teaching. So the Buddha said that there were three essential aspects to Buddha Dharma and to practice. So in a sense, you can think whenever we are wondering what practice is or wondering if we're practicing, that these three elements, these three aspects need to be present. And so the first is that we are calming the mind, that we're developing our mindfulness and concentration. The second is that we are examining and sort of bringing into alignment our moral integrity through our thoughts, words, and actions, so that we are more and more ceasing from harmful actions and bringing forth beneficial actions, creating positive or wholesome karma rather than binding or negative karma. And the third is wisdom, insight. And so the Eightfold Path, as you've seen in your studies, is a sort of the first expansion or the sort of fleshing out of those three forms of training. So Right understanding and right thought, also described as right intention, is within the training of wisdom. Speech, action, and livelihood is within the training of morality and compassion. And effort, meditation, or mindfulness and concentration are in the realm of wisdom, or rather concentration, samadhi. And so it's interesting to note, why do you think that he presented right understanding and right intention, which is wisdom, as the beginning? Right? Because we would normally might think that we would first sort of get our act cleaned up a bit, deal with our karma, deal with our actions, and then we will, cleaned up our house a little bit, we'll then enter into meditation, and then we will bear the fruits of that in our wisdom. So why does he start with right understanding and intention, which is the wisdom training? Any thoughts on that? Just in terms of your own sense of why that might be. We got people online, so.
You have to know where you're coming from to start to clean up your house, you know. So without, you know, knowing what it is you're doing, how is it that you move forward?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Say again.
I always felt that the Buddha's self-discovery was that the wisdom was inherently there, that we were inherently in alignment. We just haven't.
And so how does that bear on his beginning the Eightfold Path with that?
It bears on it because he's saying this is something, it's already part of being a human being.
I see. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about where do we start, you know, when we come into practice, where do we begin? Well, we begin in an already present and very firmly established understanding, right? I mean, understanding doesn't start when we begin studying Buddhism. We come in already with a lifetime of a very well-established understanding, whether we're aware of it or not. And so, and part of that is, a big part of that is, the most significant part of that is our concepts, our ideas, you know, the things we believe to be true, the things we've been taught. And again, much or most of which we're not even necessarily conscious of, but we're functioning within. I mean, you think about, you know, is there any action, is there anything you ever say, is there anything you think that isn't based in your understanding of yourself and the world around you and what's going on, right? So everything we do is based in an understanding of something. And we come into practice because that hasn't worked out entirely well, right? So if that understanding is a basis, sort of the underlying basis of our lives, and we come to practice because we realize there's something missing or that we're in some sorrow, we're suffering, then that needs to be addressed. We could also think of it in terms of our conceptual mind is something that we already really trust, right? And, being intellectual in this sense doesn't mean having lots of degrees. It just means sort of interfacing through the world, inner and outer, through concepts and ideas. Concepts are something we have kind of a very deep trust in already. And so one way of looking at this is that we're met with concepts, something we trust, that so that we can engage them in a sort of common, it's a language we already understand, thoughts, ideas, and so on. And so there's a familiarity there, so we can sort of enter into that. And begin to bring that understanding more into alignment with what is actually true. So that's another way we might think about it. I think the most fundamental thing is that everything we do is already based in understanding. Everything we do that we will now call practice is based in understanding. So if that's not in alignment with the Dharma, then how can we practice the Dharma? right? I mean, just think about, you know, all of the many ideas that people have about meditation, including Buddhist practitioners, right? And so we all come in with a sense of meditation being about something. It looks a way, a certain way. We expect it to experience it a certain way. It's going to bear fruit in a certain way. And so that understanding is already present, even if we've never meditated. If we just heard the word, or we've seen somebody meditate, or we've heard somebody talk about it, or just thought about meditation, we already have some understanding of that. And so based on that, we will bring that into our meditation and try and make those fit, right? And so when somebody comes here to train, what's the first thing that happens? We greet you at the door, and then we take you into the Buddha Hall and introduce you to meditation. So the first thing that happens is developing a right understanding about meditation. So what is right understanding based on your study? Just in, how would you tell a stranger on the street?
Well, there's two sort of points of view. So there's the mundane right view, which is the law of karma and how that works. And then there's the super mundane view, which is basically the Four Noble Truths. That's knowing that, you know, the way that we want the way that we're trying to get what we want isn't working, and that we kind of have to give that way of wanting things up.
Hmm. So what's another way of, so that's one way that right view is spoken of, is in terms of these two kinds of right understanding, if you will. So what is, how else could you think, just in a very simple way, of those two aspects, Robbie?
That we all are born with Buddha nature.
Well, that's a little bit of a projection into those two. You know, if you think of mundane, so just think of the words mundane and super mundane. So, what's that kind of telling you right up front? Mundane is in the realm of what? Well, it's more sort of seeing things on the surface, gaining understanding on the surface. It's conceptual, right? It's based on what you can understand, you can study, you can learn, you can sort of relate to, you can understand the idea of it, right? And so super mundane is then based more in what?
Beyond appearance.
Hmm? Beyond appearance, but it's really pointing to direct experience. So you could think of mundane right view as where we all start, right? We all start kind of what we're doing tonight. We're talking about right understanding, fleshing it out, sort of defining it in terms of how the Buddha spoke about it. So we have a good understanding of understanding, right understanding. And then we practice that on the basis of that. And that then brings us into a direct experience of right understanding, of those elements of right understanding. So then it ceases to be just conceptual, but it's now your own lived experience. Tobek.
Can we tell that it's about selflessness?
About what?
Selflessness. About that everything is without self. This right understanding.
Yeah. I mean, but let's look at how it's actually sort of framed by the Buddha. So those two aspects are important. In the study, Piyadasi also said that there are two conditions that are conducive towards gaining right understanding. In other words, how do we encounter it? And so the first, he said, is to hear it, to encounter it through receiving the teachings. Encountering the teachings on right understanding. and then reflecting on those teachings and then bringing those into practice, because now it's your understanding of what meditation is. So now when you go to the meditation cushion, that's your inner sense of what you're doing, right? And why you're doing it, in a sense, what its principles are. So you're not just following instructions, because there's an importance in that, because you can grasp that conceptually and it kind of gives you a way to begin. But if we're just following the rule, then the moment you encounter something that wasn't discussed or that is not just a description, but now you're experiencing something live, you may not know what to do. You may not know how to respond to what you're experiencing if you're just following rules. So we also need to understand the principles underneath those rules. Like, why are we instructed in Zazen this way? Right? Why, when thoughts arise, are we instructed to see them without judgment? Like, why not judge them? Right? What difference does it make? And so we can just follow the rule, but the rule we just learned, whereas we've been judging all of our life, and so we already trust judging. We don't really trust not judging. And so the rule is very weak. Following the rule is very weak in comparison to into our habit of judging. If we understand why it's important not to judge, then that gives us a lot more, sort of foundation for trusting why we would want to let go of something that we're so enamored of, right? That's so habitual. Hearing the teachings and bringing them into our practice, and then the second condition, which is conducive to, again, to really understanding, right understanding, and from those two perspectives, what we'll call mundane and supermundane, or ordinary and transcendent, or conceptual and realized, is what's called systematic attention. And so this is the aspect of, when we speak about meditation and developing calming the mind and strengthening your mindfulness, which means your ability to hold your attention in one place, and then sustaining that, which is now developing concentration or samadhi, that in and of itself is not enough. Right, that's why there are these three aspects of training. Because the mind can be quiet, but we can still be completely deluded. In other words, the mind is still, but we don't understand things any better. We're just quietly confused. calmly suffering. and so that delusion, the Buddha said, the only thing that really uproots the delusion is insight. Right, is that wisdom aspect. And so systematic attention is, in some traditions and in some practices, a very deliberate and conscious way of sitting and turning your attention to your mind and what's arising in your mind and looking at it through certain lenses, if you will, of the teachings, for instance, the Four Noble Truths, or the lens of dependent origination, or the skandhas. And so that you've studied these different teachings that are based in describing how we experience everything and come to, create samsara, as well as how we then liberate ourselves from that. And we've understood that conceptually, and we've reflected on those things. And now you bring that understanding into your meditation in such that you're seeing the truth of those teachings in your meditation itself. In the Zen tradition, that's done in a more subtle way, let's say. In certain schools, Theravadan school and in Tibetan traditions, there are teachings and practices where it's very conscious and deliberate, and there's sort of steps by which you might take. In the Zen tradition, whether you're practicing the breath or shikantaza or doing koans or other practices, this still is important. And it's happening but it's happening in different ways. There's an emphasis in the Zen tradition in really sort of firmly establishing some calm, some concentration, some samadhi, as a basis from which to then begin to turn that systematic attention to our mind so that it doesn't just immediately revert to conceptual thinking, you know, where we're just looping back into sort of thought processes. And so this systematic attention is really, it's not sitting in thinking, and it's not sitting in just being active in your mind. It's directing a very grounded, stable, concentrated mind to mind itself in a way that allows us to gain insight into mind. And so students doing koans, particularly more advanced koans, might think about how do you reflect on that a little bit in terms of your own experience of koans. The key here, though, is what makes this so important is that it is going beyond the conceptual. Okay, so that's very important. And that's why having established some concentration is really key. Because otherwise, again, the tendency to just get into discursive thought is so powerful, and again, we trust that, that we have to, have established a ground from which to actually sit and be stable, and then be turning the mind in a deliberate way, such that that doesn't get upset, doesn't begin to unravel and just slip back into habitual patterns. Does that make sense, Eduardo?
So how does that fit in with this being the first of the Eightfold Path before going into developing concentration?
Excellent question. So let me go ahead and read this. There's a sutra that I think Piyadasi refers to, which is an excellent sutra. And it's a sutra on hang on, is that right? It's a sutra in which the Buddha expounds on right view and looks at it from 16 different perspectives. And so it's fascinating to see how he saw right view as being that our capacity to sort of examine and understand right view through all of these different teachings that he had already presented. So, actually, I'm mixing sutras here. Hang on a second. Everything I said is true, but put that aside. that's another sutra. I want to come back to this other one. Let me just read a section of it. And it pertains exactly to your question. So the Buddha said, now what, students, is noble right concentration? What is right concentration with its supports and requisite conditions? So what are the conditions necessary to bring right concentration forth? The Buddha said, any singleness of mind, single focusedness of mind, equipped with these seven factors, right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, is called noble right concentration with its supports and requisite conditions. So any single pointedness of mind that has all seven of the Eightfold Path are necessary to bring forth right concentration. This is very, very important to think of, to reflect on. What he's saying is concentration doesn't exist apart. You can't divorce it from these other factors. They're integral. One leads to the next in a certain sense. They all depend upon each other. They're codependent. And so what is that telling us about practice? Right? That we have to be engaging all of these. So if we come in and just like, I just want to get enlightened, You know, like all this other stuff is fine, but I'm just going towards the vault, you know. And so I'll deal with this other stuff later. And the Buddha's saying, no, you can't do that. That's not the correct path, it's not the path. And it's not just because this is the way I laid it out, so this is the way you got to do it. It's this is the way we're built. This is what it means to a human being. We have to, if we actually want to develop right concentration, as it's taught in Buddhism. So it's not just concentration as it exists according to what anybody thinks it is. Right concentration in Buddhism means this. It means that we have right understanding, we have developed right intention, that our speech is non-harming, that our actions are non-harming, that our livelihood is non-harming, that our effort, in other words, that's what samadhi means in Buddhism. So somebody could have concentration by just, but that's not right concentration. You understand what I'm saying? It's not understood as right concentration. Right concentration necessarily means we're engaging in all of these other aspects so that your whole being is transforming. Right? It is a whole path. It's not separate. You know, this is one of the concerns, criticisms about mindfulness movement. You know, as it's taking an essential, an integral, and very powerful part of the Eightfold Path, and it's sort of pulling it out and just teaching it, you know, in a secular form. And what a lot of Buddhists are saying is it's no longer right mindfulness. You can't separate it out, right? It's something else now. It may have value, it may help people, but it's not right mindfulness, right? It's very hard to understand that from an outside view. And so the implications of this are significant. And then he goes on to talk about what is right view. He says, well, first of all, what is wrong view? And then he goes through a list of different kinds of wrong views, like there is no fruit or result of a good or bad action. Karma doesn't exist. It's not real. There is no this world, no next world, no mother, no father. In other words, just sort of a view of denial of existence. And then he talks about what is right view. Well, right view is where we do recognize that cause and effect is an immutable truth, and so on. And then at the end he says, one makes an effort for the abandoning of wrong view and for entering into right view. So that's what we're trying to do, is we're beginning with, you know, false views of things that are the basis upon which we're living, and they're not really working because they're not in alignment with what is true. And so we're trying to let those wrong views go and enter into right view. He says, this is right effort. Okay, so remember the original question is, in order for right concentration to be brought forth, all of the other seven aspects of the Eightfold Path must be present. And so now he brings it back to right effort, which effort, mindfulness, and concentration is the concentration samadhi aspect of the training. and so we enter into right view. He says, this is your right mindfulness. Entering into right view via right effort, because they're working together. That then becomes your right mindfulness. And so then he says, thus, these three qualities, right understanding, right effort, and right mindfulness, run and circle around right understanding. They're all integrated. They're all working together in this sort of mutually integrated, supportive, you know, feedback kind of system, where they're all building on each other and informing each other. Okay. You know, as I've studied this, what it does for me is, has done for me, is help me really appreciate the rather than just seeing the Eightfold Path as well as these seven steps, you know, so there's this one over here and this one over here and this one over here. And, you know, this one really resonates with me. This one, I don't know. And it's just sort of seeing it the way we see everything, which is kind of, you know, disjointed and kind of fragmented and, you know what, which can lead to what Dada Roshi used to call, what do you call it, cocktail zen? Huh? Yeah, but he called, you know, like, you're at a party and somebody brings, or like a tray of hors d'oeuvres. You know, it's like, oh, I like that. You know, and it's sort of we pick and choose, you know, the aspects that we want. And so what the Buddha is saying as far as the Eightfold Path is concerned, you kind of got them, they're all. Take one of each. Okay? Anybody else before we give it up?
In terms of that non-conceptual and conceptual understanding and process of working with those two elements, it feels like a leap to have the conceptual mind kind of buy into the non-conceptual part deeply.
Say that again?
It feels like a rub or a leap for the conceptual mind to fully kind of maybe relent to the non-conceptual or to
don't we know it?
And I mean, think about it in terms of like ego syntonic and ego dystonic, you know, this sense of it being congruent with what I am okay with or not.
Yeah.
And you know, in your experience, does the Dharma ever become ego syntonic?
Meaning
like that it's in alignment with what I feel is good in life, what I can,
yeah, because the more we are letting go, I mean, we're going to come to that. But the Buddha talked about, delusion basically being, you know, an aspect of delusion being seeing what we have experienced as pleasure and positive and good in the past, and now we're realizing that wasn't really what was going on. You know, or that there were elements of it that were not that. And so, you know, in the beginning, there's you know, kind of the practice of renunciation, of letting go of what we really don't want to let go of. You know, we still believe in it. It still gives us pleasure, but we know it's hurting us or it's holding us back. And so we, you know, with some faith, we practice letting go, but we really kind of don't want to. And so there's a struggle, and that's so much of the struggle. And that as time goes on, that we, in letting go, you know, because it's hard in the beginning. You think, you know, I'm going to let go of all the good stuff. And first of all, that isn't what we think it is isn't what actually we're doing. But also that we think by letting go of all what has been the good stuff, we're just going to be bereft. And what we don't understand yet is that what we are tapping into, what we're reclaiming, is so much more. Is so much more deeply satisfying. I mean, remember, dukkha is a basic level of dissatisfaction. And so we're trying to satisfy ourselves with all of these very fleeting, ephemeral pleasures, many of which have genuine pleasure in them, some of which really don't. But they're all fleeting. And we're trying to make them stick and give us something more lasting, but they won't. And so when we relinquish that grasping and really, you know, and this is all integrated with the path itself, where we're working in a sense on all these different levels, inner and outer, that we begin to experience life in ways that we truly cannot imagine or conceive of, because it's the same life. You know, it's not like we're doing wildly different things that are giving us, you know, that deep pleasure. That's sort of the old paradigm. You know, I just need to do really different things and then I'm going to get that pleasure from the outside. But rather, I'm actually living the same life, but now all of those barriers to experience that ultimate satisfaction, which is present within us, is being discovered and brought forth.
How does that relate to what you were responding to about the conceptual and non-conceptual? You know, that the conceptual mind has so much difficulty kind of relenting to the...
Well, in a sense, it's kind of like I mean, there's some things that we just need to let go of because they're just not healthy. You know, they're not, they're harmful. But much of what we're letting go is not the thing itself, but it's our understanding of it, it's our projection, it's our expectation, it's our grasping. And that's true with concepts as well. That's just a whole nother realm of objects, right? That we have a particular understanding of, relationship with, clinging towards, and so on, a reliance upon. And that, the more that gets clarified as we understand not just what concepts are actually worthy of holding, but how to hold them in such a way that they don't recreate that whole samsaric cycle of grasping, but also that they actually are, in a sense, vehicles to moving beyond just a conceptual way of experiencing things. And so then, I mean, have you ever had the experience, those of you who've done Sesshin, where latter part of Sesshin, your mind's really settled, and now when you think, it's really strong, right? So if you fantasize, it's like, whoo, right? Because it's, your thinking is very powerful. And so you're kind of getting a window into the power of thought when it's based in mindfulness. You know, so then our conceptual processes, which in the beginning were really kind of wild and untamed and, you know, not really based often in what's true, are now, we're developing some mastery over this incredibly powerful aspect of our consciousness to then apply it. I mean, so that's really what's happening in the very beginning. We're beginning to engage concepts in a way that is ultimately going to be very powerful, in a very different way than we're used to. And that we'll be able to use those to actually bring us to a non-conceptual understanding. And that's a long road because we have such a deep, you know, habitual relationship with concepts that is very hard to let go of and shift and so on.
For me personally, something Zen doesn't talk a lot about, but I think is really present, is devotion, faith that becomes confidence. So I think for many of us who have practiced and have strong conceptual hooks, being around our teacher and senior monastics who really have trained and changed kind of cultivates devotion and faith, so that as it keeps us kind of going and helps offer some food mm-hmm. for the conceptual mind, so mm-hmm. that eventually for it becomes experiential. Mm-hmm. And so it's no longer a conception. We don't need faith and devotion because now we have the confidence. But I think what this Sangha offers that's so precious is to have our teachers and the monastics who have all lived the Dharma and changed so much. It kind of motivates, I think, a lot of us.
Sure.
And then it becomes ours also.
Yeah, and I would also say that, you know, everyone is an example. You know, I remember the first time I went to ZCLA many, many years ago where Dada Roshi trained. You know, I was just a young, you know, punk. And I went out with him and, you know, there were, I don't even know if anybody was ordained yet here. You know, Tai and Kyoto, I don't know if they were ordained yet. So it was, you know, a fairly new sangha. And I went out there and, you know, I was sitting a session with people who had been practicing for decades. And it was like, whoa, this is good, you know. And I wasn't even talking to them. I didn't even know who they were. But it was just being in that atmosphere. But, you know, we're providing good examples to each other all the time. And, you know, beginning students can do that. And that we're also, as soon as you begin practicing, you're beginning to have experience, right? That's what you're doing. You're practicing, which means you're experiencing practice. So it's important also, although when we talk about non-conceptual and sort of direct seeing, that has certain meaning in Buddhism, that from the very beginning we're beginning to translate that conceptual into our experience, because you're practicing in your mind and body, right? You're not just sitting there thinking about Zazen, you're doing it. You're not contemplating non-attachment, you're not attaching, right? It's becoming embodied from the very beginning. You know, it's hard to see because it's hard to see anything. There's just so much going on. So it's hard to really appreciate and be so encouraged from our own example in the beginning, because it's hard to even see that that's happening. But that comes. So now let's look at the three sort of understandings of right understanding. And so so the first of these is to understand. So what are the things in terms of the teachings? But really, the teachings are just reporting on what is true in the human realm of existence. Right? Because the Dharma is the law according to human experience, because we're dealing with human consciousness. That's our area of study, right? So we're not here to realize dogs and cats and birds and bats and trees and rivers. They're fine, right? They've worked it out. Because we also can't do that for them. I can't even do it for you, right? We're dealing with this very specific instrument of human consciousness, right? Which is a specific instrument, right? Other animals, mammals, who have brains, perceive the world differently. A dog lives in a dog world. They see and hear and taste and touch the way dogs do that. That's not our world. And so we're really looking at our business. What is our business? And so the first is to understand the karma in the sense that it is an immutable truth, like you can't opt out. You know, like I say, you can not believe in gravity, but you're still subject to it. And so karma is a basic truth. And it is to understand, as the Buddha said, that you are the owner of your karma. It's the one thing that belongs to you. That, as the Buddha said, we are owners of our karma. We are heirs to our karma, which means we inherit our karma, right? And this is from the perspective of rebirth, past lives, because that is what travels forth in rebirth through what we speak of as consciousness, is your karmic obstructions. And so that's why it's one of the big motivations for living this life as well as you can. So we inherit them. We are born of our karma, the Buddha said. So from a Buddhist perspective, we're actually born because of our karma. The karma is our birth is the result of karma. And we can also look at all of these in terms of moment to moment. Birth and death. So in each moment, we're inheriting our karma. In each moment, this moment arises because of our karma. We are related to our karma. So karma, in a sense, is a much closer relation, as one of these teachers spoke about, than our family, right? Because they're with you all the time. Karma's with you. These relations with you all the time. We abide supported by our karma. And whatever karma we do, whether good or harmful, of that we will be the heirs. So that's what we inherit. And so the first aspect of right understanding is to really reflect on that and take that in and begin to take responsibility for that, which means we need to reflect on it, which means we need to study, well, what does karma mean? How do we understand karma? And then to reflect on each of those things. So to try and study, and so that you're gaining not only understanding, but faith that that is so, right? So it's you're kind of translating a Buddhist teaching, something that the Buddha taught, into being something you have faith is true. And then over time, you see that it's true. You know that it's true because you're experiencing it. Okay, any questions about that? Basic. To show.
One of the things I struggle with, or don't fully understand, is everything. We're all connected. So, like, I don't just have my karma. Like, where does my karma end and Natalie's karma begin? Or it's all, like, this nation has a karma, and we're certainly paying the price for it. Now, there's group karma. The Sangha has it. So could you, say a bit about that? Because...
Yeah. So, first of all, when the Buddha said we are the owners of our karma, that doesn't mean that karma is a thing like an object that you possess, right? Like a thing. It means that we are responsible for our own actions. Our thoughts, which are based in intention, right? Intention is the next aspect. And our words and our actions. That even though we have all been socialized and taught many things by our culture and parents and so on, some of them very useful, some of them not useful, some of them true, some of them not true, that we have grown up in different conditions. Some of those conditions have been favorable. Sometimes they're very adverse. So we have been affected in our consciousness through the thoughts, words, and actions of others, both individuals and groups and societies. And then we've absorbed that as we've experienced, come into contact with all that, and they become part of our consciousness, my consciousness, which means they become enmeshed in my desires, in my thoughts, in my words and actions. And so when I even say my words and actions, what does that mean, right? What it means is that I am responsible. And this is kind of a hard truth, I think, can be, that for someone who has, you know, had a very difficult life or has not had many advantages or has had a lot of advantages held back or has experienced, you know, violence or just a very difficult or dangerous world, which none of which may be their fault. You know, it's the world they were born into. That from a Buddhist perspective, our actions are our responsibility because we are creating them. And we will both reap the consequence of that, and we will also bring those consequences to others. And we're, in a sense, the only ones who can ultimately change that. We need a lot of help, but because they're my thoughts and you can't do that for me, and they're my words and actions, you can't do that for me, they become my sole responsibility. Right. In a very real sense, we have a shared responsibility because we are influencing each other. And that's part of what a monastery is, you know, is both doing that solitary work, but really trying to help each other. And one way we can do that is be good in our own practice, because then we're creating a better relationship and environment for everybody else, rather than adding to their burden by bringing my burden to them, you see. And so, does that help? Okay. Natalie?
So what is brought forth?
What is what?
What is brought forth? What karma, like when, if I'm, I don't know if I'm understanding correctly, but in terms of karma that's brought into a next life or existence, I mean, what is that? I mean, if what we do now, it's sort of like a pebble in a pond with the waves, okay? But what is then brought over to a next existence or whatever?
Well, you know, the Buddha spoke about this in a lot of different ways to try and convey this, because the way we tend to think about that, because we're so embedded in the notion of a self and a sort of a permanent existing essence, you know, like a soul that is me, that when we hear these teachings, we think, oh, well, that part of that me, right, which is the owner of this karma, moves forward from one moment to the next and from one life to the next. But that's not the correct understanding. So the Buddha said it's like, you know, it's like a candle flame. you know, that each moment it's a candle flame, it's a single flame, but at each moment it's also not the same because it's burning. Another analogy used was of a river, that in every moment when you step into the river, it is at once the same river and not the same at the same time. And so there is that continuum of karma, and yet it is not you, right? It is my responsibility, but my, is it, the word my or mine is a convention, is a word that we use to try and communicate that it is my responsibility not to communicate that I exist as a separate entity, right? And that karma exists as an object, just like I have a car, right? And so we have to, you know, understand we're just using conventions that keep kind of hooking us back into that dualistic way of looking at things. Okay, you go.
So what has been striking me is how active you have to be. You know, you have to really be awake and pay attention. And it's not just practice. There's something about all these readings that just it's like, you know, you really have to be engaged. You know, you can't just like sit back. You know. And I know you know.
Well, you can but, sit back, and be. I mean, you said it's so active. I mean, it's, and then you said you have to be so aware. So let's look at it that way, that it's, you know, that the path means we are practicing, and cultivating each of these aspects.
Yes.
Throughout our day, throughout our lives.
Yes.
Right. As a way of being in the world. We came into practice with a way of being in the world that we're constantly doing.
Right.
Right? We're not starting something new. We're trying to refine and illuminate, yes, and liberate.
But we're awake, you know, but to be awake for it.
Right.
And so what I keep thinking about is all the time I was not awake for it and how I screwed up. And how, you know, when you're not like really awake, it really gets you.
That's right.
So I'm just feeling all of that,
yeah,
and deeply,
yeah,
and like I think like young people should be taught, like, you know, just pay attention. Like this is really important, you know. Like
Yeah. You could just imagine the reception.
Yeah, right.
I agree. And but, you know, I think all of us sort of come into practice and have those moments and periods of reckoning. Reckoning. You know, it's sort of like, oh, it's like the Book of Days. You know, it's like we're seeing our life, you know, that we've been trying so much not to see for so long and has so much help in not seeing. And now we're seeing it. And so, yeah, it can be painful. But, you know, but then just come back and be aware and realize, but wait a minute, you're here. You're doing this, you know, that maybe all of that, or, you know, was what was necessary for you to get here. Right? Hallelujah. Yeah. So the second part of right understanding is now with that understanding of karma as an immutable truth. Let's go on to the next part and then I'll ask this question. And so this is to examine and clarify our understanding of how karma manifests in particular ways that are of great importance for human beings. And so they're sort of roughly analogous to the precepts, but they're a little different. So they're basically ten wholesome actions. And so not killing, not stealing, not misusing sexuality. That's not how it's usually phrased. But and then four different kinds of false speech: lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle speech. Covetousness, which we could also think of as greed, anger, and delusion. Right? And so you can see, and so this is part of the original teaching, so you can see how the precepts sort of developed out of these. And so, right, understanding in this sense means, and remember that sutra I just read where he said, based in right understanding, we then bring that forth into right effort, which is recognizing what creates positive, helpful karma and what creates binding karma. What is a skillful action and what isn't is an unskillful action. Right, we need to know. Right, we need to know. I mean, just think about zazen. You know, how many times have you encountered something that is not easy, and you're making decisions about how you respond to that in your zazen, right? And so you want to try and know is first of all what's arising is that wholesome or not? Is it skillful or not? Is it something you want to strengthen or is it something you want to let go of? And then if it's something, and then on either side, how do you do that? How do you be skillful in letting go of what needs to be let go of, and how to strengthen what needs to be strengthened? And so, and that's right effort. And so within these 10 wholesome or unwholesome actions, the other side of them, we are examining and really understanding the karma of those actions. And why is that important? Why all this emphasis on karma within right understanding?
So we can wake up.
Well, say more. What's the relationship?
Because our path is going to be arising and our realization is going to be arising out of our own direct experience of our life and our ongoing clarifying of that. And that's going to be developing. So we're actively developing our own kind of way forward.
Yeah. And that way forward is through what you're thinking, what you're right. saying, and what you're doing.
Right.
We keep right. turning those wheels. And so if we don't understand karma and what is skillful and not skillful, because those habitual ways of turning those wheels are so strong and powerful, and they are us, right? That's the way we see it. They're who I am. They're my identity. And they're what got me this far, right? So in some sense, I equate them with success, even though they've brought some suffering. But, you know, that's just collateral damage. You know, there's this whole structure that I'm trying to, in a sense, disbelieve from a state of deep belief. You know, see through clearly from a state of cloudiness. And so, meanwhile, you know, everything is not on pause. I'm still living. I'm still doing all the same stuff I was doing before. I'm waking up. I'm going to work. I'm having relationships. So to understand this so that we can, it's like trying to get your hands on the wheel, you know, so that you can actually start heading in a better direction. Doug, why don't you wait for you got one, okay.
So it sounds to me that there's a suggestion of choice, of control. Mm. And it always seems kind of contradictory to me, like this, in one sense there is this concept of a conditioned reality, of a lawful, unfolding reality where one thing conditions the next mm-hmm. and is conditioned by so mm-hmm. many other things. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, so where is the place of choice within that? Because even when I awaken to my own conditioning, that is, I am conditioned in a way to reach that point and like, in the same way someone else wouldn't be and wouldn't reach that realization. And then is there really choice within this whole cycle?
Yeah. That's a good question. There are a couple of ways that that's happening. One is that when something just arises in your mind, right, you didn't ask for that. That wasn't a choice, right? You just, the thought appeared, or it was a memory, or suddenly there's an emotion, right? Somebody says something and you feel, you know, happy, or you feel angry. You didn't decide that you were going to have that emotion. It just arose. So in that moment, that arises because of that conditioning, and it in itself is a conditioned object, right? It's dependent upon, right, all of these aspects, which is the skandhas and dependent origination of these teachings, for it to arise. In that moment, now that it's in your consciousness, you're making choices now. So that's the moment where the karma that brought that fruit forward is now being strengthened. And if it's beneficial, then you want to strengthen. If it's not, then you want to weaken it. Or not. Right? And so that moment is where practice occurs. And that's why it's so important to, you know, try and be diligent, going back to the awareness, because if we indulge, you know, sort of are lazy or just, you know, going for it, or we're not noticing, those patterns are just continuing and they're strengthening. And so when we're practicing, there's a kind of an interruption. And then the other aspect is that as we're practicing and within the whole of the Eightfold Path, and you're developing your sort of moral alignment, which means you're doing more good than harm, and that's having a direct effect on your meditation, right? Because you're feeling more at peace and less regret and remorse, and you're feeling, you know, you're just settling. And so your concentration is deepening, and then that brings you to insight. That while all of that's happening, everything is in a state of all of that, those conditions, the conditions themselves are changing. The karma that those conditions give rise to is changing. And most importantly, how you understand all of that is changing. That's the insight. And so, you know, we can have faith in letting go of attachments and practice that diligently, but still believe that everything I'm experiencing has its own solidity, its own sort of independent existence. It's still something that's happening to me. And so to gain insight into its essential nature as empty is what...
So that's completely my direct experience, in a very, of course, like just a small taste, but I'm asking whether, like, on a not a relative level, on a other level, on an absolute level. So me even being able to reach this point, like I'm thinking there is something maybe a little bit deterministic about, you know, who even like gets this spark of
yeah. If I'm understanding your question correctly, that's where the beginning with conceptual understanding and intention and, you know, all of the sort of self-awareness that we bring into practice, that as that develops, as it naturally will, that brings us to the point where all of that begins to drop away. Right? In other words, a sense of practice, a sense of intention, the sense of, you know, being diligent, the sense of I am practicing, the sense of concentration, mindfulness, all of that drops away. Okay. So the third aspect, which is important, I want to make sure we get to, is so we talked about just recognizing that we're the owners of our karma, seeing how that manifests in these specific ways that the Buddha brought forth, because these are the ways that we either create the most amount of harm in one action or create a great deal of harm through innumerable small actions, right? That binds us and binds others. And then the third is to understand the Four Noble Truths. And this is really what the Buddha over and over and over again brought it back to, was understanding the Four Noble Truths. And that sutra that I alluded to and then moved away from He talks about right understanding from the point of view of understanding aging and death. He says, when a noble disciple understands, has right understanding about aging and death, the origin of aging and death, right, the cessation of aging and death, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death, they are now in the path of right view. So you see what he's doing. He's taking one aspect, which is the understanding of aging and death, and working it through the Four Noble Truths. And then he does that with clinging. He does that with craving. He does that with feeling. He does content. He's doing that with the skandhas. He does that with the six senses. In other words, and this goes back to the systematic attention that we talked about, where you're bringing your awareness and examining how suffering arises through clinging, craving, feeling, contact, how what the origin of that suffering is, how it comes to cessation, and how the path to that cessation. And that, so he's it's like an incredible, like, mandala, right? Where each of the aspects of the Eightfold Path are interlocked, and then he begins, and then he takes the first aspect, right, understanding, and kind of integrates them with all of these other teachings, right, through the Four Noble Truths. And so that really just underscores how foundational that first teaching was. You know, the arising of suffering, its cause, its cessation, and the path itself. Which is really saying that that's a teaching we want to reflect on and examine over and over. You know, it's sort of, I think sometimes, you know, with teachings that we receive at the beginning, and then it's like, okay, I've got that, let's go on to the meaty stuff. And what he's really saying is it's pretty much all here, right? But we have to keep looking at it and seeing it more and more clearly and in all of these sort of different manifestations, if you will. Any questions about that? Okay.
I wanted to talk about the word suffering here. There's something about that word that is problematic for a lot of people. I'm thinking about an inmate that I heard from today who kind of grabbed onto the more negative aspects. The mm-hmm. word has connotations of negativity, that it's so deeply painful. And some of suffering, some of dukkha, the way the Buddha speaks about it, he speaks about all of sensation and feeling as dukkha.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to make that distinction because I think we fall into this sort of dour view in which at the same time, if it's seen through, is joyful and blissful.
Mm-hmm.
So just to use that word is a problem because it's a bad translation of a complex word.
Yeah.
That means non-permanence, non-self, and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think in a sense, any term that we're using is problematic. And that's not to dismiss what you're saying. It's problematic. So other, you know, like unsatisfactoriness, dissatisfying or disappointing, you know, those are also true and they give a different, you know, sort of a different perspective. And they're also problematic, you know, because they can also might diminish the truth of suffering. And so I understand what you're saying. I think that's where, you know, both in presenting the teachings and in studying them, we really need to study what does dukkha mean? Because then we realize it's because we, you know, suffering, our mind goes to a particular sort of arenas of pain, and that it is much more profound and subtle than that. And in fact, it's talking about many things that we don't even experience, wouldn't relate to as suffering. And so, which is very interesting, right? It makes it much more interesting in a way, because it's not just, well, I'm trying to just stop having these really sort of large, egregious, you know, woes in my life, but everything else is fine. You know, what the Buddha is saying, if you actually look closely, we see all these very, very subtle levels of dis-ease, right, that we don't even recognize as that. So, yeah, I think it's a part of the transmission, you know, to the West. I think it's part of developing ourselves as Buddhists, is to understand, you know, to take the language and understand it, and then, you know, so we understand it better. Can you pass it up to Laura?
So at the last study session, you were saying that, and we were talking about now, everything we experience is dukkha. Mm-hmm. And then there's nirvana, mm-hmm. liberation. But can it also be seen as more, like with a more interwovenness, like the way Dogen speaks about practice enlightenment?
Well, in the Mahayana, samsara and nirvana are realized as one. And so it's not the extinction of samsara, right? Because samsara doesn't exist to be extinguished. It's realizing the unity. I mean, that's prajnaparamita, is realizing the unity of everything. And so that it's not... that it's not about extinction, it's about illumination, right? But there again, if we go back, which is, you know, right understanding, right view, enlightenment, but then we have to go back to the Eightfold Path and realize, but I can't just enlighten, I can't, everything can't just be, you know, I can't be dwelling in samsara and then suddenly I'm enlightened and now I'm living an enlightened life. Because everything in my body and mind is still based in samsara, right? All of my habits, all of my sort of emotional base, all of that, that doesn't just in one instant become clarified, right? I may see into the nature of things, but all of the sort of the inner machinations are still working. And that's why actual practice, right, where you're actually... evolving it, you know, you're in all of this, and you're you know, letting go, you're shifting all of the things that are binding and strengthening those things that are affirming and liberating, and so that as we begin to gain insight, there's a kind of transformation that's happening within us, that we have a much better chance of actually living it, integrating it. You know, this is the danger of this sort of divorcing or compartmentalizing, thinking, if I'm just enlightened, then, you know, I'll be this really swell guy, you know. And that even with understanding, right, those habits are still there. The ones that are still strong are still there. And so we still have to, you know, be very diligent and committed to integrating, which means taking ownership of our karma, you know, and just continuing to do the practice. It just keeps evolving as we evolve.
So I was curious about studying karma. There's this side of me that leans towards like making assumptions about kind of what karma means. Like, okay, 2 weeks ago I was lazy about leaving my coffee in the car and now it's moldy. Like, that's a consequence of one of my actions. But then there's, if every single action that we take is karma, I don't exactly understand.
Every intentional action. Every intentional action. And that just, that means that it's based in, you know, it's based in your consciousness and what we're, everything we're talking about, which is your understanding and your intention and your desire, the way you see the world, what you want, and what you, how you think that action is going to fulfill, be a part of that fulfillment, right? And so, and that because it's an intentional action, there will be a consequence. And so then the question for a sincere practitioner who really wants to be awakening is that helping me? Right? That becomes a very, very important question because I don't want to mess around anymore. Right? I actually want to be affecting change in the right direction. Right?
So, but ignorance creates karma too. Right?
Yes. Well, I mean, so, the within a view of delusion or within a deluded view, we think, we act, we speak, and that creates karma. So, was that your...
I guess in terms of intention, like there's this side of it that says, okay, well, I didn't know or I was ignorant. So mm-hmm. there's this intentional decision, but then there's like you know, our ignorances and our blindnesses cause... immense amount of harm. So that's
right.
I think that's part of what's confusing is like, in some ways, I'll have no idea yeah. of some of the terrible impacts that I'll make throughout my lifetime.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that's going back to what Nyoko was saying. That's where we start to, it's like, that's the reckoning I was talking about. It's like, oh, you know. And so, I mean, that's just part of what we take on. I mean, what's the alternative is to just go back and pretend, you know, I'm who I want you to think I am. But we can do that, you know. And it also is a very good motivation for becoming more clear, you know, and doing our study. Because we realize, oh, I am right now, I am every day doing things that I'm not aware of. You know, in the Beyond Fear work, you know, I've tied and made that connection with, you know, intention versus impact. You know, because as white folks often, you know, it's like, oh, I didn't mean to say that offensive. I'm sorry you were hurt by that, mm-hmm. right? Rather than saying, I didn't see my own blindness. And I'm sorry that what I did, you know, hurt you. And so it's the same. Yeah. I wanted to touch on one thing because we're running out of time here, which is... that Bhikkhu Bodhi makes a point in his text, which I thought was interesting, that he said that right understanding helps to clarify some misunderstandings about that people have held about how the world works, and both historically as well as today. And so the view of a kind of a nihilistic view that when we understand that actions do have consequences, and that that's just a basic truth, then that helps to clarify or sort of defeat the idea of nihilism, that nothing matters, right? And that what I do has no impact, because we just see that that's not true. That the moral teachings, the moral truths that the Buddha brought out are really presented as universal principles of good and evil. You know, it's not just a Buddha system. That these are universal truths within the human realm, which is why you see these basic teachings appear, you know, throughout history and in all different kinds of cultures. Because, and that's based on the understanding of what actually leads towards peace and harmony and well-being and what doesn't. And that that's true regardless of time and place and culture, that they're universal truths. And so that helps to defeat a sense of ethical subjectivity, you know, or relativism. You know, it's like, I think killing is wrong, but if you think killing is okay, who am I to say? You know. And I mentioned a while back, I read a book on this huge survey that was done of 20 and 30-year-olds on sort of moral views. And the researchers, as they did the study, were surprised and alarmed at how much moral relativity there was sort of across the board. That this sense of, and they conjectured that it had a lot to do with seeing the ways in which moral views are used to oppress and kind of subjugate and you know, are used as weapons, you know, righteousness. And so it's sort of going to the other side of like, we don't want to do that, so who am I to say what's right and wrong? And so the Buddha was very clear about that. And I think that's an important thing to contemplate. And then the third was a more deterministic or sort of just sort of a realism sense of, you know, that life is, that you can choose freely, that you can't make choices that have any impact. You know, everything is determined. And that what karma shows us and what study shows us is that we are making choices and we do have choices, but that those are also set within conditions. So Buddhism doesn't teach free will. In fact, I don't know if that idea even exists outside of Western sort of philosophy and thought, because we don't have absolute freedom, right? Because we're working within a conditioned mind and so on, but we do have choices. And so karma is not deterministic in that sense. And so, I mean, if that were true, then we'd be out of luck. And that has a lot, also ties in with a question that's often been raised. It was brought up in some of the texts about if the self is empty, then how can you be the owner of your karma? And that's where the Buddha used that analogy of the light, the candlelight, or the river to talk about that it's not that in every moment, right? It's not you and it's nothing other than you, right? You are not the same, but you're not different. And that's why, you know, because our conceptual mind can only hold that with difficulty, that we practice and realize that is true. All right, any final, before we finish?
I'd like to come back to karma. Because you said some people like to think of karma as in, like, this moment coming alive, a day-to-day karma. Did the Buddha specify in what is right karma, right understanding of karma? It's not this small term. It is a lifetime. It's based on lifetimes and having a...
It's based on, yes. I mean, that's the that's.
And if
the,
you don't believe that, that's not right understanding, correct?
Well, that's is debated. I mean, that is something that teachers and scholars write articles about.
What did the Buddha say?
Well, the Buddha definitely taught rebirth, but there was a cultural understanding of rebirth, but that didn't mean that everybody believed in it. And so there is a sutra in which he is talking, I think it's a lay person, and who's clearly has questioned the notion of rebirth. And the Buddha said, look, if rebirth exists, is true, and you live the best life possible based on this right understanding, then you will ensure the best possible life in the next round. If rebirth does not exist, is not true, and you live the best life possible in accord with what is true, then you will have lived the best life possible. Kind of hard to argue with, right? It's pretty good logic. And so, but to me that was interesting because it was clear that he actually wasn't in that sutra trying to convince this person that rebirth existed in the way that he taught, but rather, whether you believe it or not, what it really comes down to is what are you doing today, right? What are you doing with your life? That's really what it comes down to. You know, whether rebirth in the traditional sense is true or not, you know, that'll get settled later.
But he starts it off with right understanding. It's tied mm-hmm. into right understanding.
And so, but see, you can understand rebirth really in I don't know, I haven't really thought about it methodically, but I would say virtually all of its ways of understanding it from the point of view of moment-to-moment life. You know, what propels it? The self is empty, right? If the self is not a fixed, you know, constituency, but is a single entity that exists autonomously, then what moves it from one moment to the next? Right? How's that happening? I asked the wrong question. If the self is empty, lacking that autonomy, lacking that self-existence, then what? There is no essence. Then what is it that is the continuum from one moment to the next? Right? And the answer to that is the same answer as what moves this, we call ourself, from one lifetime to the next. It is consciousness imprinted with our karma. So either way, you can understand, and it is understood even in traditional Buddhism in both ways. It's understood as a lifetime to lifetime and as a moment to moment. Okay, so in 2 weeks, I think, we come back again to look at right intention, the second. So please study, and we'll continue.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.